This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Social media's political ugliness. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
At times, it seems that political postings to sites like Facebook and Twitter are out of control with incivility. How did we arrive at this point? We'll explore.
Is 20 years the new stadium lifespan in Major League Baseball? At least one facility may be closed sooner than that.
Blair Walsh may be joining the Kickers, who have missed a crucial field goal in the playoffs, then suffer the yips the following season. Hear who's on that list.
And the new trend in dollhouses, it's called bashing, which means making structural changes to those old Victorians.
Well, they do take saws and knives and basically break apart these old-fashioned dollhouses to make them seem more contemporary. So they take out walls and add or take away staircases, enlarge bathrooms, make open floor plans, and then add these modern fixtures.
How about that? Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron on what's going on with people who are intense about dollhouse designs. She's here later in the hour. Well, you may have heard there's an article in the Cincinnati Inquirer by a guy named Dan Horn, and it's quite possibly the dumbest article about politics ever written. The reporter is a fool, and the editors are morons. Actually, he wrote all of that, trying to make a point about the incivility of social media. He joins us now. Dan, what have you found?
You know, what we found is there's a lot of ugliness out there. You know, as a general rule, I try to stay away from a lot of our comments and our Facebook page myself this time of year because things get pretty ugly. But I had to do a deep dive for the story and spend a lot more time than I normally would there. And it did not disappoint me in terms of how toxic some of that stuff got.
I think all of us have seen it in some way, shape, or form on our Facebook feeds or in tweets or whatever. But where did it come from? Anybody try to address that, like kind of just the incivility?
Well, there's a lot of theories out there, and one of the popular ones is that as we've moved more toward online communications where people don't have to sit down and look at each other and talk face-to-face and eye-to-eye, that it's a lot easier to say things that maybe you would never say if you were sitting in a room with somebody. And that rings kind of true to me, I think. And then you add to that just the nature of this election and just how nasty it's been and some of the things that the candidates themselves have said. And I think you put all those things together and you get permission to kind of go out and say some of this stuff.
Man, I think what bothers me, and I'm sure you see it too, is kind of the anonymity. Somebody unwilling to stand up and put a name behind one of these provocative statements.
Right. You do get a lot of that. We moved a few years ago to Facebook comments only, so people have to have a Facebook account comment on our page. Now, granted, you can make those up too sometimes, but what's interesting is that even with that requirement, you see a lot of really nasty stuff being said, but people are just putting their names to it. You know, they got a little picture of themselves with their kids on there, and then they're saying pretty nasty things to each other on the website.
Yeah. You bring up the issue of the long-term consequences of all this online anger. Did you find any here? Anybody offer anything?
Well, I talked to some folks at the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and this is the group that started after Gabby Giffords was shot. As a, you know, there was a lot of talk at that time that some of the heated discourse led to that assassination attempt, and so they formed this group and they've looked at this a lot. And their fear is that as we become more detached from, you know, just talking to each other face-to-face and trying to work things out face-to-face, that long-term it could cause some issues for our government and for our democracy. And you look at what goes on in places like Congress these days, and there is more incivility than there used to be. And I think their fear is that that's only going to get worse.
We're speaking with Dan Horn, reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. His piece is called "Your Candidate Stinks. Social Media Goes All In on Political Incivility." Anybody say that this might be just a phase, like we're still managing or learning to manage social media and the consequences? Like, might we develop a thicker skin or something? I don't know.
Sure. I think there's some hope that that's the case. There's no way to know for sure because we are still relatively new to this. And, in the early days of this kind of communication, maybe things are a little uglier than they'll be when we figure all this out down the road. But for now, I think it's not getting better. Part of that may just be the kind of election we're having this year, and people feel emboldened to say and do the things they're doing. But, no one knows for sure. Like I said, the fear, I think, among some folks is that this is a new normal in terms of political conversation.
Yeah. What do the likes of, Facebook or Twitter say? Because I know they've got to be cautious with, obviously, First Amendment, free speech rights and stuff, but some of this stuff just seems so hateful.
Sure, and that's always an ongoing debate. A lot of these social media companies have to deal with that. We have to deal with it. You guys probably do too on your websites. There's a desire to not curb free expression. We're all in the free speech business, so nobody wants to do that. But at the same time, it's our site, and if people are harassing each other using sexist or racist slurs, those are things that get flagged and get addressed. But certainly the big social media companies have been reluctant to go too far with this stuff because they don't want to curb free expression. It's their bread and butter, and I think that's understandable.
Yeah.
The hope is that people kind of figure it out themselves and police themselves over time.
Mm. We could, just go back to what our moms taught us back in the day, right? If you have nothing nice to say, don't say it at all. That really seems to ring true these days.
That's right. A former Republican mayor I talked to for this article actually said, as a general rule, I think, don't act like a three-year-old.
Yeah.
If you can manage that,
right,
then you're probably going to be okay.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Horn, great piece in the Cincinnati Inquirer. 13 minutes now after the hour. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's one of America's top 10 for business, where 2,000 burdensome regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years and is now home to the sixth best entrepreneurial climate? All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Again, that's MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Law enforcement groups are pushing back against what they say is unfair scrutiny of fatal police shootings of black men recently in Charlotte, Tulsa, and El Cajon, California, which have brought outrage and condemnation from community leaders and some politicians. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borlein. Valerie, what are you hearing?
Well, there's a sense among law enforcement officials that they are scrutinized even when they're doing things by the book. In particular in Charlotte, where there was a fatal shooting of Keith Scott, a police officer, the chief has expressed some frustration with saying, "Hey, guys, we're following our training. Our guys did what was appropriate in a threatening situation. Why so much second-guessing?" And this this current of feeling like, among law enforcement officials, that they can't win, even when they try to do their jobs, has led to some frustration and to some pushback.
Yeah. And I think we've all heard that phrase, the Ferguson effect, right, where cops may be slower to respond in theory to an emergency. Did that come up at all in this?
Yeah, the Ferguson effect, you hear an awful lot about it. And you're right, Gordon, one aspect of it is this fear. And there's been some evidence that this happened immediately after Ferguson in 2014, that police will be more tentative about the way they conduct business. But the corollary to that a Department of Justice study found was that, in fact, the Ferguson effect may actually be these incidents stirring up frustration among black people and communities, and emboldening people that say, "Hey, this is wrong," and that instead is what leads to the violence.
All right. So what kind of pushback are we hearing then?
Well, there are these, for example, there are these legal defense funds that police can pay to join either through their union chapter or individually. I think it's $68 a year for an individual to be able to have a lawyer of your choice if and when something happens, whether you were in the right or potentially not. There have been pushes on social media from police officers saying, hey, there's so much noise out there cracking down on us. Can people that support Blue Lives Matter and these other causes speak out as well? So there'll be some vocalization of our, you know, our where we're coming from. And there have been some laws passed in the past several years, a move towards a Blue Lives Matter law, and which would make things like attacks on police a hate crime, essentially making them a protected class of people. And there's some indication that when legislature's coming back in session, especially in red states, that those laws may get renewed interest.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal national reporter Valerie Borline. Her piece is called Police Push Back at Scrutiny of Fatal Shootings. They do seem to be between a rock and a hard place at times, I must say. I know in Charlotte, the feeling is, well, wait, we got to turn this video over to the district attorney first. You know, that's evidence. We can't just start throwing evidence out. I guess I sort of see both sides there.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's really caught law enforcement off guard. In many cases, they do want to release the video. They think it supports their position, but just as a piece of evidence, it's the fact that memories are very pliable. So if you haven't interviewed all the witnesses about what they saw and they see the video may likely influence their recollection. So that's one aspect of it. And as well, I think that there's a sense among criminologists, the people that study this stuff every day, that if anything, these videos and seeing what happens in these sad cases may force a conversation about use of force around the country.
Right.
And so even, you know, how we move, you know, they call it the ladder of escalation of force, how you move from, you know, baton to taser and on up to lethal force may force a conversation about changes in training at some point.
Right. All right, so the surveys do seem to indicate that a lot of people think there's a problem here, and it may be broader than just the shootings, correct?
That's correct. The Pew Foundation came out with a survey on Thursday that found, in fact, great disparities among race. As you know, whites tended to think that police acted appropriately, and then non-white people tended to view police actions and use of force with much more skepticism. So, but even, you know, even broadly, there is questioning about use of force, and that's changing over time.
Thanks, Valerie. Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borline. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Remember when former baseball commissioner Bud Selig stepped down 2 years ago and he pointed to all the shiny new ballparks that opened on his watch? 20 of them, to be exact. He was probably expecting they'd last a bit longer than they might be. Jorge Ortiz at USA Today says the Braves have said goodbye to Turner Field, only 2 decades old. Another facility is in the same age range is on the endangered list, and a third one, even younger, could be abandoned as well. Jorge, what's going on here?
Certainly Turner Field, which is on its last legs, and that's only 20 years old. You know, it was opened as a Centennial Olympic Park, and it was converted to a baseball field after that, and it has... It's the Braves are moving to suburban Cobb County. So that's a ballpark that you figure would have lasted a good 50 years. Now it's rendered useless. In Arlington, you're going to have the voters decide in November whether to fund a half of a $1 billion ballpark that has been proposed for the Rangers to replace what's now known as Global Life Park. That was 22 years old. And so, you know, you also have in Phoenix, the Diamondbacks making noises about possibly leaving Chase Field, which is only 18 years old, because of a dispute with the county over repairs and upgrades. So you start pondering whether, you know, the lifetime of a ballpark now instead of 5, 6, 8, 10 decades is just 2 decades.
What's the motivation in Atlanta?
In Atlanta, they want to create an entertainment district, a destination. They want, and this is not just in Atlanta. This is happening in Arlington too. Although in Arlington, what they're selling is the idea of a of the roof and, you know, climate control and better weather. But the idea is that in with the location of Turner Field is not really desirable for people to go and spend time before the game and afterward. And so they want a place for one closer to what the Braves contend is the real fan base in the suburbs, but also a place where they're going to create shopping spots. They're going to, you know, retail outlets, restaurants. They're going to have a hotel. So the idea is for people to go there regularly and spend a lot of time, particularly before and after games, as opposed to just driving to the game, you know, watch it, and then get the hell out of Dodge.
Wow. We're speaking with Jorge Ortiz, sports writer at USA Today. His piece is called As Turner Field Shuts Down, MLB Ponders, Is 20 Years New Stadium Lifespan? All right, so you said baseball doesn't think this is a big concern. These are unique situations, right? But where else are there potentials? Because a lot of stadiums have popped up right over the last, 25 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, that was the legacy of Bud Selig. He's very proud of it, and for good reason. You know, they baseball managed to get 20 new stadiums built in his 22 years in office. It's like, you know, he was inaugurating a new stadium every year, which is great. But as I mentioned, new amenities and new technology emerges. There are times when ballparks can be kind of retrofitted or changed to accommodate some of the changes. And in some cases, they can't. In some cases, you're going to have the team saying, "Hey, you know, Las Vegas is talking to me." Yeah, you know, as they're doing with the Raiders, and you know, what can you do for me? So, do we see one other team right now that's ready to make this move? We don't, but I think there is that concern because, you know, four franchises are a monopoly. There's only a certain number of them.
Thanks, Jorge. Jorge Ortiz, writer at USA Today. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Trips to the post office, as you know, are never convenient. So why not get postage right from your desk with Stamps.com? Stamps.com even gives you special postage discounts you can't get at the post office, including first class, priority mail, express, international, and more. You'll never pay full price for postage again. Here's how Stamps.com works. Using your own computer and printer, buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then just hand your mail to the mailman or drop it in a mailbox. It's that easy. It's no wonder over 600,000 small businesses are already using Stamps.com. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A four-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Get started with Stamps.com today. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter Deal. White House staffers, you have been warned by President Obama. If you want to avoid a headache next year, don't imitate Bill Clinton's team on your way out. We're referring to transition pranks, a tradition embraced most energetically by Mr. Clinton's staff when handing the reins to George W. Bush back in 2001. It's a story from Elise Vibeck at the Washington Post. Elise, what do we have here?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. White House people who exit and hand over the reins to a new administration are known to occasionally pull a few pranks on the incoming administration. And what I found is that the most egregious examples of this happened between the transition from Bill Clinton to George W. Bush. And in fact, these pranks and acts of what I think the Bush administration would call vandalism were actually so bad that they triggered a Government Accountability Office investigation. And some of the stories are pretty funny. Others are a little bit worse because I think that it cost the administration some money to do repairs. But things like recording obscene voicemail greetings, damaging furniture, gluing televisions, gluing drawers, you know, certainly those Clinton aides wanted to make it known that they weren't very happy that Bush won the election.
Wow. Geez. So I guess some of that would be positioned as, I don't know, kind of fun or prankish, but other examples there seem like they were just downright nasty.
Yeah, a few of them. And I think that what was interesting about this case is it really taught the Bush administration and now the Obama administration how important it is to make sure that those procedures go smoothly and that aides know that there could be consequences if they do things like this. We know that actually the transition between Bush and Obama was one of the best ever. I was speaking with a few people this morning involved, and they just said that the Bush administration, probably because of their experience coming in and having things be such a mess, was very classy in the way they handed off power. And so now the Obama administration is doing its best to make clear across all departments, across the White House staff, that they will not tolerate any nonsense and that they are going to do it up to the Bush standard.
That's something. Wow. We're speaking with Elise Vibeck, national political reporter at The Washington Post, about her story called Memo to Obama Aides, Don't Prank Trump or Clinton on Your Way Out. You mentioned in your story, too, Al Gore accidentally took a bust of Abraham Lincoln home. What is that?
Yes, I know. Isn't that a great little detail? So this came from that Government Accountability Office investigation, which produced a report of about 220 pages describing the state the White House was in and going back and forth with a variety of parties. And this was a really interesting find for me. Obviously, I had never realized this. It wasn't a tidbit that was discussed much in D.C., but yes, apparently in Al Gore's ceremonial office, so the vice president's ceremonial office, there was a small bust of Abraham Lincoln that was missing when Vice President Cheney came in, and Cheney's staff sort of registered this and were asking around trying to understand what had happened to it. And once a former Gore aide heard about this, they were able to locate it in Gore's private residence. Now, the report says that this was an accident, and so that's what I write in the story. They obviously did more investigating on this. Apparently, it was a staff member who was cleaning up Gore's office, starting to do some packing, and probably just believed that that was something that Vice President Gore owned, when in fact it was property of the office.
Holy smokes. That's unbelievable. So
I know.
Are there actual memos circulating now, like, say, from the White House staff to saying, listen, guys, this is not a time to mess around?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, there are emails going out on a regular basis to White House staff talking about the way that senior Obama officials want the transition to be run, which is without any of these shenanigans. And across the federal government, in fact, there are meetings and planning sessions about the transition. We're talking about every federal department, every federal agency. They're really starting to take this process quite seriously. Because when you think about it, I mean, every 4 to 8 years, you know, the government essentially gets remade. It's an enormously complicated process for even just a single agency. And so when you think about it across the entire government, you're talking about quite an undertaking.
Thanks, Elise. Elise Vibeck at The Washington Post. How about those stories? 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump aren't the only ones who are expected to be in top shape in order to get or keep a job. Although those of us who are not running for president of the U.S. might assume our physical health is not as relevant to our professional lives. In some cases, it may come up during an interview process. What's allowed and what is not in terms of what's being asked of you? Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Lots of controversy lately over the presidential candidate's health and medical records, but Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump aren't the only ones who are expected to be in tip-top shape in order to get or keep a job. MarketWatch's Maria LaMagna has the story. Maria, what are some of the other jobs that require workers to be healthy enough to perform?
There are a lot of them, and maybe unsurprisingly, a lot of them have to do with safety. So, you know, a lot of jobs in transportation require medical exams, a lot of jobs in law enforcement, firefighters, even private security guards, you know, pretty much any job where other people's lives are in your hands, you probably have to undergo some type of medical exam yourself before moving forward in the job process.
You may take some tests before you get the job, and then do you take tests along the way as well?
Yes. So for some of these jobs, there's an annual medical exam that you have to submit to your employer, frequently for transportation-related jobs, because, you know, your employer wants to make sure that you remain capable of doing the job. So yes, there are definitely a lot of jobs where you might have to take an annual physical or something like that.
Your story mentions that there are some other jobs in which you need to get tested, including corporate executives. How'd that come about?
Right. So the corporate executive part is a little bit different. I think there's been some debate, actually, about how much medical information CEOs should be required to disclose to the public. That obviously came up during the health issues that Steve Jobs had while at Apple. And, there's some controversy about how much they should be disclosing to shareholders. But, yeah, I think each company probably handles that differently as far as whether they need to take a medical exam every year or that kind of thing. But I think, the main thing is that it may be written into a CEO's contract if they become unhealthy or, reach a certain age that they may not be able to take the company forward. So that probably would just be written into their contract on a company-by-company basis.
Maria, do you think any people in companies fight this kind of thing, the executives?
That is a good question. I think there is a lot of concern about privacy and, obviously there are laws in place about what you have to disclose, during a job interview and that kind of thing. And I do think people are worried about how much information their employers have about them, especially now that we have wearables and all these incentive programs for wellness in the workplace, that there has been some debate about that as well, just how much you should be required to turn over. So I think there are certain situations where people don't want to give that information over. And, if you work in one of the jobs that it's required, you have to do it. But for some other companies, again, probably on a company-by-company basis, but I'm sure that is something that people debate and take up with their HR departments.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Maria LaMagna at MarketWatch. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Everyone knows that business is all about numbers. Consider the numbers the state of Michigan can offer your business, like Michigan being one of America's top 10 states for business. Or 2000, the number of burdensome regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6, Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climates, which all adds up to the one state that has all that and more. Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. New trend in the housing market, redesigning Victorian homes, more specifically, dollhouses. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron says a lot of structural renovation is taking place as people get tired of the traditional, old-fashioned aesthetics. Ellen set this up.
For generations, dollhouses have been stuck in a mostly Victorian or Georgian style, very old-fashioned. So think frilly tea sets and Queen Anne chairs. And there are a group of hobbyists who have started doing what they call bashing dollhouses.
All right, so bashing doesn't necessarily mean with a sledgehammer, right? What do they mean by bashing?
Well, they do take saws and knives and basically break apart these old-fashioned dollhouses to make them seem more contemporary. And so they take out walls and add or take away staircases, enlarge bathrooms, make open floor plans, and then add these modern fixtures, like you just mentioned, the Sub-Zero refrigerators and Ames chairs.
Wow. So these Ames chairs, for example, or a Sub-Zero refrigerators, these companies actually make products for that? Like, do they cater to these hobbyists?
No, the hobbyists make them themselves.
Okay. That's really something. But what do you have to have some sort of working knowledge of home remodeling, or not necessarily?
It doesn't seem that way. There's a very supportive community of dollhouse bashers online, and they trade and swap techniques and tips. Sometimes bashes go very wrong, and so you can take your dollhouse into a dollhouse shop if your neighborhood has one. There's a growing community of these people who are really enjoying making these contemporary dollhouses.
Wow. We're speaking with Ellen Byron, Wall Street Journal reporter. Her story is called Ames Chairs, Open Floor Plans, and Sub-Zero Refrigerators for Your Dollhouse. The pictures that accompany your story are actually amazing. How much time do some of these folks spend?
People spend hours and hours on this very precise work, and it's incredible. A lot of these hobbyists, it seems to me, are drawn also to this challenge of trying to recreate in miniature detail the real world. And online, for example, when they post their work, it's often hard to tell if you're actually looking at a dollhouse.
So the people who do the hobbyists who do this, then is there an intent to, say, sell this somehow, or to show to your Facebook friends that your kid has the best dollhouse ever? Like, what is
well, there... some people do that, and some people do actually flip dollhouses. They buy a used one and completely renovate it and sell it to someone who wants a modern dollhouse but doesn't necessarily have the time or ability to do it themselves. Many of these dollhouse bashers create works that are so delicate that they're really not even intended for children.
Mm. Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. By the way, do-it-yourself renovations can create miniature mishaps like sagging floors and additions gone awry. She wrote about Darren Scala, owner of D. Thomas Fine Miniatures in Hastings-on-Hudson, New York. He says sometimes it's better to paper over old wallpaper because improper stripping can look as lumpy as in a human home. He often helps clients strip walls, sand floors, and upgrade dollhouses to LED lighting. This past Monday night, Vikings kicker Blair Walsh missed his third field goal of the season so far to go along with two blown extra points. He missed just five field goals all of last season. He's fresh in many minds for missing a short field goal in the final minute of last year's wild card game against the Seahawks. Is he cursed? The Wall Street Journal says it appears Walsh may be the latest kicker for whom an epic postseason miss means trouble the following year. In fact, the Journal says since 2000, kickers who have shanked crucial playoff kicks haven't just declined in efficiency the following year, but quickly found themselves out of the league altogether. Billy Cundiff, Mike Vanderjagt, and Doug O'Brien never kicked for their teams again and only hit 62% the next year. Only Cundiff, by the way, survived past the next season. Former Chargers kicker Nate Kading saw his accuracy drop from 91% in 2009 to a pedestrian 82% the next season. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Thanks for listening, and we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review and comment for us on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.